Thank you very much indeed for your invitation from yourself and Billy to come here today, which I was delighted to accept. John's give a sort of potted history of my time in journalism. Funnily enough, the first job I ever had in journalism was a summer post with the Lurgan Mail, which was then on Windsor Avenue, just around the corner. So not there anymore, but I do know Windsor Avenue and I do know this part of Lurgan and a little bit about this part of the world. And I know a little bit about Brownlow House as well, and it's definitely a privilege to get to speak here. You getting the okay down at the back? Yeah. Thanks very much. Funnily enough, there's a connection between this building and the Irish News. The Irish News, inexplicably to me, although John has hinted at it a little, sometimes gets criticised. Many years ago, one cynic described the Irish News as a paper which had nothing to offer other than deaths, dogs and dogma. Now, the dogma aspect is debatable because I do think that the paper has a strong tradition of making its columns open to all views, even in a divided society. In terms of deaths, we're quite proud of our family notices. They give us a direct and a personal link to all our readers. They're a reasonable source of revenue as well. But what I cannot dispute is that the Irish News was always noted for its greyhound coverage. It's been a long time since the great days of Dunmore Stadium and Celtic Park, which were actually cross-community venues many years ago. They're long gone. But the most famous greyhound of all, and a hero to readers of the Belfast Morning News, which was the predecessor of the Irish News, was, of course, Master McGrath. Now, Master McGrath was three times the winner of the Waterloo Cup in England. Back in the days before Sky Sports, but long before television even and radio, Master McGrath was a bigger celebrity than David Beckham or Wayne Rooney are today. Back in the 19th century, Master McGrath made a fortune for his owner, who, as some of you may already know, was Lord Lurgan, resident of none other than Brownlow House. And the legendary champion greyhound is buried here in Lurgan. So I suppose the only remaining question is, what paw did he dig with? Was Master McGrath a Protestant or a Catholic dog? Well, he was born in the south, he lived in the north, he belonged to a prominent unionist family, and he took a lot of money off English bookmakers. So I think we can all claim him, and the Irish News certainly does. Anyway, I've been asked to speak to you about what the Progressive Unionist Party needs to do to be taken seriously by readers of the Irish News. I've been encouraged to challenge you along the way, so I'll try to do that as politely as I can. I'll offer you some thoughts while stressing that I'm here as a journalist, not representing any community. I've never been a member of a political party. As Groucho Marx had said, I'd never join any group that would let someone like me in. So I'm not expecting an immediate meeting of minds, but the world would be a dull place if we were all on the same wavelength all the time. I think it's very much to the credit of your party that you're prepared to listen to what I have to say. And if, when we're all finished, you look at me the way Michael O'Neill looked at his defenders after the defeat in Azerbaijan last night, you know, I'm sure we can all live with that. The Irish News, it's probably fair to say, is a paper which is from the Catholic and the nationalist tradition, but hopefully reaches out to all sections of society, even in the middle of all the problems and the confusions and the confrontations in which we so frequently find ourselves. One of the ways in which we set out to do that is by reporting on as many different news stories as possible, as long as they have some impact on our readers. Most of our political coverage is going to focus, naturally enough, on nationalists. But we did, as John has mentioned, provide a double page spread on Billy Hutchinson earlier this week, which I hope set out his views very fairly. And I should say it was published before I was asked to come along here, so it wasn't a deal in any shape or form. We also want to offer a strong range of columnists. So we have people like Brian Feeney, Fionnuala O'Connor, Tom Kelly, Jim Gibney, who come from different strands within nationalism. But we also have writers like Alex Kane, who would be from a fairly mainstream unionist background, Newton Emerson, name-checked earlier because he manages to annoy just about everybody, but also from a unionist background. Until recently, when he stood down because of other commitments, Roy Garland, glad to see Roy's here today, and also formerly the biographer of Dusty Spence, he was a distinguished contributor to the Irish News for almost two decades, so glad to see Roy looking so well here today. Irish News readers are drawn from a variety of backgrounds, but as I've said, and at the risk of stating the obvious, most of them are Catholics. And despite what you might hear to the contrary, my firm experience is that most Catholics are still nationalist in some shape or form. It's been a little ironic to hear some DUP figures seizing on opinion polls, which suggest that Catholics are less nationalist these days, because those same surveys have always underestimated the DUP's own level of support, and they've overplayed an endorsement of what might be regarded as the centre ground. So I would suggest is that what's changed among nationalists since the ceasefires of 1994, the Good Friday Agreement of 1998, and the ebbing and flowing of devolution since then, are perceptions of partition. Since the foundation of the State of Northern Ireland over 90 years ago, most nationalists, and this won't come as a surprise to you, would simply have said that the border was the main issue, its imposition was wrong, and needed to be removed as part of any political settlement. Now, over the last 20 years, more probably over the last decade, many nationalists have moved to the view that the border might stay in place as a line in the map, but almost in all practical terms, it's no meaning anymore. And one side effect of all that is that the journey from Belfast to Dublin, which used to be a fairly tortuous affair, customs posts, military checkpoints, dreadful roads, and could nearly take you 4 hours to complete, it's all been transformed. These days you leave Belfast, brilliant roadworks, motorways, dual carriageways. You can make it to Dublin if you observe most of the speed limits most of the time in just about 90 minutes. Some people might say that's nationalism's greatest achievement in living memory. So things do move on. And I suppose what I'm suggesting there is that nationalists have been pragmatic about the border, and events have moved forward as a result. And it might just be time for unionists in general, and perhaps your party in particular, to be a little more philosophical about flags and about parades. And I listened carefully to what John had to say about all those issues, and I understand fully where he's coming from. I know how important symbols and emblems are to many people in the Protestant, Unionist and Loyalist tradition. The image of the Union flag coming down from Belfast City Hall clearly caused major upheaval. I'm also aware that it was the two larger Unionist parties, rather than the PUP, which coordinated the leaflet campaign against the Lions Party, which in retrospect I think has to be regarded as a pretty shabby episode, which had serious consequences. But that was not the fault of the PUP in any shape or form. However, I do think that the previous policy of the PUP, which supported the flying of the Union flag at the City Hall on designated days, made much more sense than the proposal that it should be in place 365 days a year. Everyone, Unionist and Nationalist, agreed on designated days at Stormont, which, after all, is where all the serious executive powers reside in this part of the world. When that happened, not only did the sky not fall down, but very few people actually noticed. Now, it's different at the City Hall, the symbolism's different, and the shock of the flag being removed pushed us into the familiar territory of a perceived gain for one side being regarded as a defeat for the other. But taken to the streets to restore the status quo, I feel may have missed a key point. The vote which caused all the fuss at Belfast City Hall was a democratic one, and the switch in the balance of power on the council which made that possible came about because Alliance worked exceptionally hard on the ground and won a series of seats, not just through first preference votes but through lower preference transfers, and that enabled it to switch the balance of power at the City Hall. Now, Sinn Féin had been involved in much the same process. The SDLP would try to be involved in much the same process. I'm sure that's occurred to the PUP in great detail, and if the PUP can do what other parties have done in the past, are just as well organised, and there's an election coming up at the City Hall next year, if there are new motions and new dynamics at the City Hall as a result, then no one, Unionist, Nationalist or otherwise, could possibly complain about such an outcome. I suppose marching issues are going to be more complicated again, as the Parades Commission is not an elected body. But if Unionists do not like it, they should remember they had the opportunity to replace it during the Hillsborough negotiations of 2010, and it was internal disputes involving Unionists and the Orange Order which ensured that the Parades Commission remains in place today. I do think that the Commission has a thankless task, But if unionists want a different formula for assessing the same old problems of what constitutes dialogue and how you balance rights against responsibilities, then it's really up to unionists to produce some coherent ideas which they can agree among themselves and then set out to agree them with nationalists and the governments as well. I do think that the PUP can play a fairly central role in all that, and if they do, they'll be taken very seriously indeed by Irish newsreaders. I also feel that the PUP needs to present itself as very much an alternative to the DUP and the Ulster Unionists, which is something which is already on your agenda. John mentioned Hugh Smith there, and I certainly send my best wishes to him as well. I knew him 25 years ago when I covered Belfast City Council. Very strong personality, a great character. Stood up to the two main unionist parties pretty frequently and came at the argument from the left side of the debate. There's no doubt about that. And clearly, the PUP is a left of centre party in a field which is dominated by conservative elements. That must give you the chance to develop your own priorities. You must judge those priorities for yourselves. If they're going to involve street politics and flags and parades, that's your call. But regardless of those matters, there are other options available to you out there. The PUP is a relatively small group, but it was able to influence the dramatic account of the outcome of the East Belfast parliamentary election of 2010 and the victory of Naomi Law. Some people think that Peter Robinson has never managed to quite get over that setback and would put regaining that seat for the DUP almost ahead of every other consideration which is out there. There's also going to be a pretty tight contest in North Belfast the next time round, and a small number of votes from the PUP or elsewhere could prove decisive in that constituency as well. There seems to be an assumption out there that your party is inevitably going to endorse the DUP on both fronts. But as I'm sure many of you have realised, you're in a very decent bargaining position. And you're in a position which could go well beyond flags and parades. If you were to use that opportunity to push for investment in social areas in both those constituencies in a way which would benefit residents on both sides of the divide, many people would start to regard the PUP in a very different way, in my view. If I'm being asked to suggest another area where PUP members might move specifically forward in the eyes of Irish newsreaders, then perhaps surprisingly the GAA offers another possibility. Now, I'm not suggesting that Billy Hutchinson should turn out at full-back for Antrim next year, but probably could do worse. However, I do think that nationalists and unionists often regard each other with mutual incomprehension, and many people do not realise the sheer scale of the GAA in the north and across Ireland. They don't really appreciate that it's not really based in politics. It's based on pride in your own area, in your own district, in your own village, in your own town, in your own county. And doing the best you can for your own area. The GAA has developed hugely because of that. And people in the GAA are working with other sports and, crucially, with other traditions to increase understandings and insights in all directions. Some of that's going to be beneath the surface, out of necessity. Some of it's also in the public domain. There may be some people in this room who are already aware of those outreach programmes which are already underway. They may even have some involvement. And there's an opening there for all of us to find out more about each other as a result, without in any way compromising principles on any side. I also think in order to understand where you're going, you also need to look at our past and our shared history and how it can teach us that the divisions in our society are not set in stone. For example, it was not just Protestants and Unionists who put on British uniforms in the past in this country. And it was not just Catholics and Nationalists who suffered during seminal events such as the Great Famine of the 1940s, when over a million and possibly closer to 2 million people died across Ireland. There are small groups in unionism already looking at these matters. Some of them are connected to the PUP. They know that people of all religions and of none died from hunger and neglect during the famine, not just in the west of Ireland, but in the north, and in places like East Antrim and the Shankill and Hollywood and the Ards Peninsula. Protestants who survived that crisis also emigrated in enormous numbers, and that had huge consequences for the demographics of the entire island of Ireland, and it influenced political patterns which are still being played out today. I have a good friend originally from Boston, Massachusetts, called Frank Costello. He's engaged in some fascinating research projects in these areas, which are reaching out to people from all traditions They're encouraging them to look at what is a British identity, what is an Irish identity, and how a shared history connects us all. I commend that kind of process to you. You might have been better having Frank Costello along here today. But there are people from the Donegal Pass, there are people from the Lower Newton Arch Road and elsewhere who already know all of this. And they know that none of their beliefs are being threatened as a result. Some of them may be in this room today. And they will certainly be taken very seriously by Irish newsreaders as they go about their endeavours. I could have mentioned when I referred to Lord Lurgan earlier that he was the second holder of that title. The first was his father, the first Lord Lurgan, and he worked on behalf of the ordinary people of this town, Protestant and Catholic, when they needed his help during the crisis of the 1840s. He caught famine fever as a result, which was a fatal strain of typhoid, and he's buried in a Protestant cemetery not very far from this house. So we can all live together, we can all respect each other, no matter how difficult the circumstances, and I think that the spirit of previous residents of this Brownlow house can take us a long way forward. Thank you very much indeed.
Thank you, Noel. Noel said that he would be happy to take a few questions and answers. If anyone would like to raise any issues with him or ask about anything. Well,
you asked me about the Northern Ireland Defence last night, if you want.
What defence? Exactly. Yes, although Ulster did beat Leinster last night in the rugby. Maybe if I just ask you, I'm intrigued with your comments about GAA and the sort of local pride. And I know that I've had nationalists say to me, you know, loyalists can be very negative about their about everything. Do you think we need to learn a lesson about seeing the glass half full and being more positive and proud of our communities and our neighbourhoods? Do we have a rather negative mindset that we need to learn from the GAA a better approach?
Sure, if you know, hear me there. I do think that people can learn from the GAA in some shape or form. The GAA does not have a monopoly on pride in its own area. I mean, I have to come clean here and admit that I did play some Gaelic football and hurling, but also played some soccer along the way. And I remember some years ago playing in the Dunmurry League and having to go to an away fixture against Rathfarn Rangers. Don't know if there's anybody from Rathfarn Rangers about. They have pride in their own area, I can tell you. Still shaking at the memory after all those years, but that sort of spirit can be used in a positive way in many different areas, and I do think the GAA is a little bit ahead of many of the soccer clubs, maybe even many of the rugby clubs and many of the other sporting associations, because it's channeled it in a very positive way. It's got the best out of people in its own area. It's got total commitment right across the board. I remember a guy called Nick Hornby wrote a book about Arsenal Football Club a few years ago, which was made into a very popular film. And in that book, which is called Fever Pitch, he was a fanatical Arsenal supporter, and he considered the possibility that Arsenal might someday field players from their own area, a team of 11 guys from that part of North London, and then thought it's impossible. And these days, no one from the Arsenal team is from their own area. Practically none of them are from England. In the GAA, everybody's from their own area. Everybody knows everybody, and that's how it builds up and it takes things forward from there. But that hasn't been sufficient for the GAA. They have tried to reach out in difficult circumstances, because we all have our own history, we all have our own traditions. But there are very clear examples of politicians from other backgrounds who are linking up with groups from the GAA. I think that there's going to be an event this coming week at which all the main parties are going to endorse that. And I do think it offers a way to develop communities and to push things forward. The GAA has no monopoly, as I say, on pride in the community. That has to be a positive. That has to be a positive element which can be utilised in many different ways.
Linda Irvine.
Talk about sport. You talk talk about our shared history there with the family and I'm involved in that, but also our shared linguistic history with the Irish language. So do you want to say something about that?
Yeah, well, I'm probably a bit stronger on GA than the Irish language, and maybe need to brush up as a while since I was at school in Kilkeel. But it is part of what part we are, because you know, as you can probably demonstrate, and more than most people, Ballymacarrat, Ballyhackamore, these names, where do they come from? The Shankill, old church, you know, that's part of what we are. That's part of what you are. Now, not everyone's going to identify with the Irish language, but it helps us to understand who we are and where we're coming from. It's something that's very special to readers of the Irish News. The way things are in this part of the world, it's inevitably going to turn off people from other traditions, and you know, you'll find some opposition from the start. But I understand the numbers that you're getting on the Newton Arch Road are growing and are very strong, and don't involve any compromise of principles, but involve increased knowledge and a better understanding, and I suppose a confidence in your own area and what you want to do. And I think that has to be a positive development.
Winston?
Noel, just in terms of the whole issue around education, and in particular integrated education, and could you maybe give us, you know, with integrated education sitting somewhere around 7, maybe 8%, could you give us some sense of the barriers at the integrated education from the leadership of the Irish News?
I think all the strands in education have to be given equal respect. It's a simple fact that not everybody wants to send their children to integrated schools, but they have to have the opportunity to do so. And as you say, somewhere below 10%. Now, it used to be somewhere maybe about 2%, so it's growing steadily. It may have reached somewhere close to its ceiling, but it's essential that there's parity of esteem across the board. I think, from my perspective, integrated education is a very important subject, but I don't think that the divisions in education have caused the divisions in society. I think they reflect the divisions in society, and I think society has to sort itself out. I don't think that you can expect schools to play that role for you. I think that's it's totally unfair on teachers, it's totally unfair on pupils, and I don't think we've been in a position where parents are denied the right of choice. But all our schools have to be good schools. You should have the opportunity to choose between a Catholic school, a faith-based education, if that's what you want, a state school, mainly a Protestant school, or an integrated school. And I think great progress has been made in that respect. There's some way to go. There are some areas where people don't have the opportunity to send their children to integrated schools. But in the vast majority of areas, people have got that choice, and that's the way it should be, and that's the way things should move forward.
Ken, final question, Ken Wilkinson.
Well, not so much of a question, but just to compliment you on the Irish News and blow the myth out of what we were talking about earlier on about issues. You know, many times I've rang the Irish News on the issues of within the prison and the spokesman for prisoners. You have been more than helpful. You know, with people within the Irish News and a lot of community issues that affect the royalism. You have been there, you have highlighted for me. Now, I went to a lot of papers, which people say are unionist papers, that probably has been there. So it's just a golden left out of the water to say that these have been more than helpful to me in the past and a lot of people are very loyal.
Thanks very much, Ken.
Maybe that's a very positive point to end on then. So let's show our appreciation to Noel for coming.